You're listening to Burning Bridges with Margot, and I'm your fire starter, Margot with an X. Is everyone recovering from Thanksgiving? And I don't mean from the food. We just had a very divisive election, and it left some people upset, angry, depressed, or maybe happy. How and why did someone who so openly spews, to put it lightly, disparaging remarks about so many people get elected? Who are the people who voted him for him? Today, we are lucky enough to have Dr. Elena Connor, Executive Director and Senior Research Scientist at Stanford SPARC, which stands for Social Psychological Answers to Real World Questions. Her most recent book is Clash: 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. I read a Vox article called Research Says There Are Many Ways to Reduce Racial Bias. Calling people racist isn't one of them. The challenge for anti-racists looking for solution in Trump's America. And I saw Dr. O'Connor quoted, and I had to get her on the show. So thank you so much, Dr. O'Connor, for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. And so I like to start the show with an example of a bridge you may have burned and you thought it was a terrible thing and it ended up being one of the best things that ever happened to you.
Yes. So I grew up in a working class neighborhood in Memphis, Tennessee, and my particular neighborhood was white. And across the street was a black working class neighborhood. And so we all went to the same school together. So my school was very integrated, but my neighborhood wasn't. And this was in the 80s. And in my neighborhood, at least, it was mostly single mom families. And I had a best friend named Cindy, not her real name. But so Cindy and I were basically raised as sisters because we had these single moms really struggling to make it in a world where single mothers were really not supported. We were all quite poor. And she was my best friend. You know, we spent every Friday and Saturday night together till we were probably about 14. Then we went to different schools. We kind of grew apart a little. I went away to college. She went away to college. And I met up with her again when I had just spent a semester abroad in Russia and traveled all through Eastern Europe. And she was very excited to introduce me to her boyfriend. She was like really thinking that this was the one, and she just had nothing but good things to say to him. So over dinner, over the holidays, I was talking about visiting Auschwitz in Poland. So this is the concentration camp where many thousands of Jews were exterminated. And, you know, I'd been very touched to be there. And her boyfriend says to me, "Oh, yes, that lie the Jews tell." And I was like, "What? Like, are you kidding me?" And kind of went back and forth with this guy a couple of times. And I turned to my friend, Cindy, and I said, "Why are you dating a Holocaust denier? Like, what in your life makes this okay for you?" And she got defensive, he got defensive, and I think I politely excused myself and left. And that was the end of, an 18-year friendship at that point, because we'd known each other since we were two. And I have since fallen out of touch with her. And I think, you know, you probably think the moral of the story is like, yeah, like, it's awesome that I stomped out on this, you know, best friend of mine because I got in touch with my liberal values and my belief in a just world. But actually, I think I reached the opposite conclusion, which is I should never do that. because she went on and, you know, her life, from what I can tell about it, you know, she's kind of retreated into this place of racism and sexism and classism and many isms. And I've gone on to study these things, and I, you know, kind of losing that friendship was the impetus for me to figure out how to have these conversations better so that we can learn from each other rather than alienating each other.
Wow, that's a really good example and led into your kind of life work. So if you guys grew up pretty much the same in the same area, why do you think you kind of turned to, you know, liberal values or not being racist or whatever you want to call it, opposed to your friend?
Anti-Semitic in that case. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So what makes you kind of have your values like that and she have her values, do you think, if you guys grew up kind of in the same environment?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. When I turned 14, Memphis has a really good public school, which is a magnet school, and I went there. And it turns out that school is actually in the middle of Memphis's traditionally Jewish neighborhood. So many of the kids there were Jews, lots of Asians. It was a very integrated place. And then she actually went to a private Christian school, an evangelical school that was completely white. And I think that was a really big kind of watershed moment for both of us, where I went in this direction of learning about all these different cultures and being extremely interested in them. And she went to a place that just reinforced a lot of the values and beliefs of our neighborhood. And then she went to school in Mississippi for college, and I actually was very, very lucky and went to Yale. So just our educational experiences, I think, reinforced very different ways of thinking about diversity.
And so is that what's going on now? I mean, a lot of people vote. I don't want to say the majority, because technically Trump didn't get the majority of votes, but a lot of Americans voted for him despite him being very misogynistic and racist and, all these other things that are pretty negative. But a lot of people, do they identify with that? Like, why did they vote for him?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of different paths to voting for Trump, or a few different paths. The one that I think is probably most prevalent is, many white people, I think, especially white working class people, do feel very threatened. They feel like their way of life has been threatened. They've seen their actual economic standing decline despite working very hard and doing all the things they thought they needed to do to succeed in mainstream American culture. When we know from social psychology that when people feel threatened, when they feel their social identities are threatened, something a lot of people will do is find an out-group to blame. And I think Trump really, sang from that hymnal. He really helped articulate that the Mexicans are to blame, or the blacks are to blame, or women are to blame, or Muslims are to blame. And I think that's a narrative that really resonated with a group of people who, because they're in this place of feeling incredibly threatened, were ripe for that kind of recruitment. So I think that's one of the big stories. I do think there's also very opportunistic white people who think that Trump's policies are going to enrich them economically. And I think we know they're wrong. But I think some people are a little bit less attracted to that racist, sexist, xenophobic narrative. But I do think that's actually the most prevalent phenomenon going on now.
So would you say that they're actually racist? Like, are they considered racist? Because they're voting for someone like this, and that's their attitude? Like,
that's a really good question. I think in my research and in my own life, I try to avoid labeling people racist, sexist, homophobic, simply because if there's anything we know from social psychology, it's that our attitudes are very unstable and situationally bounded. So how I feel at one time is likely to change. And so labeling people according to their worst impulses is just not constructive, either in how we think about or approach the problem or how we interact with people whom we label that way.
Okay, so then are these people voting for Trump kind of embodying a lot of the negative things that he's saying, or is it just because they want to blame someone else there? They may not necessarily think that. They may not necessarily really, hate women, but they're still voting this way because it's this more kind of like primal feeling of shifting the blame, and it's the opposite of the status quo.
Yeah, I think in the moment of casting a vote or in the moment of making a political decision, you know, what's going on for people in their minds is, you know, what they've heard Trump say and the fear and the that he stirred up in their hearts, as well as the pride that he's appealed to, this pride about, you know, a golden day in the past when, you know, when America was great, and, you know, reading that when white Americans were great. So I think in the moment of making that decision, you could say they were probably operating from something we might call a racist place, but also I'd say a very nationalist place and a very nostalgic place. But is that how they are across situations for, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year in, year out? I think that's, no, I don't think most people, I mean, of course there's white supremacists. Of course there's people whose primary identity is based on hatred of an outgroup. But that is a very, very small number of people, and it can't account for the many millions of people who cast their ballot for Trump.
So what is their situation? Like, what is going on with them? Because I think it's hard for a lot of people who don't feel that way to kind of identify with what their situation is. I mean, I live in a big city, so I'm sure that I'm not coming across people in middle America that are voting for Trump on a daily basis. So what is it that made them want this person to shake things up?
Yeah, I mean, I, from what I can tell from the people I know and the research I'm aware of, is this, there is, I think something that people on the coast don't realize is that the largest voting bloc in the U.S. is people without, white people without a college degree, the white working class. I mean, depending on how you slice it, that's probably 40 to 50% of the U.S. population. And those of us, if you live on the coast, chances are you're college educated and don't have a lot of contact with those communities and aren't very familiar with how life there has changed over the past 30 years, 40 years, and what stories people are telling themselves about the causes of those changes. And so I think when I think about my father, my stepfather, my brother, these are all high school educated men, who voted for Trump, you know, they see that their ability to raise a family, their ability to feed a family and have a dignified middle-class life has become increasingly difficult. And the story on the ground is that, oh, you know, these Democrats sent our jobs overseas. Now, that's actually kind of halfway true. You know, there's also the larger economic story that the manufacturing sector as a whole has collapsed. And, you know, where well-paying jobs are in the U.S. is the service sector, information sector, technology sector. But, you know, like, even as I said, their eyes are glazing over, you know, like, and it's just like some fancy pants liberal telling them about economic trends, where the story they're hearing, you know, in the coffee shop or in the, you know, in church or among their buddies is that, oh, Obama sent our jobs overseas. So I think, you know, it goes to show the power of story independent of facts, and also the receptiveness of people to those stories when the material realities of their lives have become worse, actually worse. You know, it's not a fiction. It is much harder to get by now, and if you are if you don't have a college degree, relative to if you have if you do have a college degree.
How did these stories get started? Because they probably weren't doing well under Bush, right? So it's not like Obama all of a sudden collapsed the economy for them, right?
Right. I mean, these trends have been going on for, you know, decades now, and a lot of them have nothing to do with little to do with whoever was in power and just the general trend of economic change. But people, that's not a very sexy story. You know, when you're talking about abstract economic trends, that those stories don't have legs. Stories with, you know, clearly identified heroes and villains, who did what to whom and why, those are the stories that really grip people's imaginations, especially when they're feeling vulnerable. And so it is very easy, or let's put it this way, it's not that hard to manipulate people's hearts and minds by giving them a clear villain to hate. And I think that's what Trump has done, and something that other leaders have avoided doing. Yeah, so sorry, that's kind of an abstract explanation of how abstraction doesn't really sell a story.
So what do we do now? Is there a solution to this kind of situation of kind of maybe changing people's views on what is actually happening and not being so hateful?
Yeah, I mean, so a few years ago, I co-authored a book called, that you mentioned, the paperback title is Clash, How to Thrive in the Multicultural World. And in that, we do lay out a plan for how do you change, I mean, we're talking about not just individual hearts and minds here, we're talking about entire culture clashes. Right? It's not just some people think this way and other people think that way. There's daily practices, there's stories, there's artifacts, there's institutions, there's leader. I mean, it's a whole apparatus. There are different apparatuses in conflict with each other. So, I mean, we talk about making change at three levels, the change of individual hearts and minds, the changes in daily norms, daily media, daily artifacts. I mean, I think, you know, the role of the media cannot be overestimated in the past election. And then finally, at the level of institutions, so are actually, I mean, this is where I think people can feel a little dismayed, but economic policies need to change. Maybe even the way we elect leaders needs to change. But for your listeners who are tuning into this podcast, you know, what can you do at the individual level? So on my blog, I kind of laid out an approach to how do you have these conversations with people in a way that you actually understand where they're coming from and advance a better approach to diversity than the one we have now. So my blog is ElenaConnor.com. And I think, you know, the first step is actually to go, well, first of all, you need to have some people from, some friends from these populations. You know, we have retreated into our bubbles and tend not to have, even if we have a lot of us on the coast, have ethnically diverse friend groups, but we don't have socioeconomically diverse friend groups or regionally diverse friend groups. So, you know, go out there and find yourself someone from flyover country and try to have these conversations, reach out, and then go into that conversation, not in the mindset of, you know, I'm going to change what you think, but I'm going to learn what you think. Because I think when we go into these conversations wanting to change people's hearts and minds is when the whole thing backfires, because that's incredibly threatening if someone is coming to you with the attitude that you're wrong and they're right, and their job is to convert you. So that would be, I'd say the first two steps are, you know, actually reaching out and diversifying your social circle, and second, like trying to learn about people. And then I point out some ways to do that. And then, you know, actually identifying your similarities with these folks, building common ground. And then, you know, being very honest with yourself and with your partner about this, your conversation partner, about why you believe what you believe, kind of what, and being very clear in your own head. I mean, I think I have a lot of lovely friends who are just woke. They have amazing politics and amazing beliefs, but when I ask them how they arrived at their opinions, it's not super compelling, right? It's no more compelling than my friend Cindy, you know, kind of floating along with the stream she was in and not questioning the norms and the attitudes. So I think for each of us to get very clear about why we believe what we believe and be able to articulate that if asked, is also an important early step to facilitating these conversations.
Yeah, I guess thinking about why you believe that, I just thought about why I believe a lot of these, I guess, traditional, progressive, kind of liberal things. And I feel very lucky that I was exposed to so many different cultures, and we had a lot of gay friends when I was growing up, and it was never a thing that I grew up with that anyone was different than me, you know? So mm-hmm. it was just like a normal thing. And, you know, a lot of people aren't raised that way, especially in probably more rural areas. You're just surrounded by people similar to you. And so being a child exposed to that is probably changes your perspective a lot about it too.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think, and you know, the word you're using, you appreciate it, you know, reveals it is a privilege. It's a privilege to live in a world with people from all over. You know, that is, if you live in a city, so cities are much more expensive to live in than suburbs or rural areas. So already, if you're able to live in a place where you're exposed to people from a range of backgrounds, already, you know, that's a gift. You know, and I consider it a gift that I was able to grow up in Memphis, Tennessee, at a time when people had agreed that integrating schools was a really good idea. And there was a lot of political will behind that. Now, that's actually dissolved since I grew up in Memphis. And now the schools are once again very racially segregated. And so, you know, the privilege I enjoyed, even as a white working class kid, is no longer there. And so I think, you know, acknowledging that being exposed to different cultures is not to be taken for granted and something to be grateful for and something to recognize not everyone has is incredibly important.
Yeah, and in the article it says not to call people racists or sexists. That's not a way to get through to them.
Yeah, so there's all types of fun experiments, and some of them I've done in social psychology, that when you threaten people's identities, you just shut down the conversation. You're like, even if you're right, you know, even if your soul-shredding analysis of everything wrong with them is spot on and even funny or eloquent, you know, they're sitting there thinking, F you, like, and they're not listening. So you just wasted a lot of wit and intellect on a pretty dead-end project. So, you know, instead of telling, and they're not going to believe you. If you tell someone they're a racist, they're like, well, you're an asshole. So, you know, I can change you. You probably can't. So, so I just think that name calling and labeling, of course, you know, I think it's hard not to do that as a species. This is what we do, is we make categories and label them. But at least if we can curb that tendency in our conversations with people different from us, we're much more likely to have a productive conversation than if we revert to our instincts to categorize and label. And label in these invidious ways, in these negative ways. I mean, nobody wants to be called a racist or a sexist.
Yeah, I think now with social media and Facebook, it's making it harder for people to have a conversation about it. It's either I'm right and I'm posting this, and when you're behind a computer, it's easier to say really negative things to people instead of having a discourse about why they feel that way.
I think social media is really good at galvanizing a base, right? You know, when I want to feel like right on, you know, you're totally affirming what I already believed, Facebook is the way to go. I do think there's things that Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and other social media could do to facilitate actual conversations rather than preaching to the choir, but those mechanisms aren't in place yet. And so in the meantime, we do have this unfortunate polarization that's been facilitated by social media.
So we actually have some questions from people who are listening, and one of them is, you know, is passivity when it comes to homophobia, racism, sexism, etc. Isn't that just as bad?
Yeah, I actually don't think listening and engaging with difference is passive. It's actually, you know, actually going into conversations and with people who are different from you and actively engaging them in conversation and exploring why they believe what they believe is an incredibly active process and a difficult process, and kind of being careful about how you engage people so that you don't threaten them, and figuring out how to frame your beliefs and frame your values and frame, you know, the world you hope for in ways that another person different from you can understand and hear and maybe even adopt is incredibly active. So I'm not saying don't do anything. In fact, what I think I'm prescribing is much more active than the approach of just trying to, I mean, if I can characterize it this way, like shove my beliefs down someone else's throat.
Well, I guess if it's like personally insulting to you, right? So if like you're a Mexican person and you're having a conversation with these people and, you know, they voted against your interest, you know, they voted for hatred for you. That probably makes it.
Yes. Yeah. So on, you know, this little, this post I put together and kind of like actual tactics for having these conversations, I really recommend using I statements. It's like, when you say that we should build a wall, I feel really angry and afraid. Like, let's talk about why you want to do that and why it might be bad for a lot of people you don't want to disadvantage. So I never endorse silence. I never endorse not saying anything. Instead, I think being more thoughtful about how we engage in conversation, because you can imagine, you know, in the example you just gave, I could say, oh my God, that's such a xenophobic, racist thing for you to say, right? And so now we're going to have a conversation about whether or not this was xenophobic and racist. But when I say, huh, you know, when you say these things, I feel really afraid and scared, and this is not the world I want to live in. I mean, you can't actually argue with me about how I feel. Like that. That's not, you know, that is a true statement. And now we can actually talk about, you know, like, is this something we as a country should do? And getting past the labeling into the very real feeling side and also democratic side of, like, what do we do with our country? Because I think the name-calling just devolves into more name-calling. This is not just an opinion. This is something that people have documented.
In framing it so that someone has a personal kind of view of it, like be able to relate it to themselves. Isn't that also a good tactic? Like, oh, well, you know, what if your daughter XYZ, you know, like was in this terrible situation and, you know, women's health care is totally demolished. Like, wouldn't you be then be concerned? You know, when you frame things in people, you know, an example that would happen to the actual person of something they're kind of voting against.
Yes, I mean, I would actually endorse a first-person perspective first, and so, I mean, I've gotten a surprising amount of traction from unlikely, unlikely people by, you know, under ACA. So I was actually denied healthcare coverage when I was diagnosed with a cervical precancer, and you know, even if it's someone I've just met and I've taken the chance, you know, taken the opportunity to listen to them, and then they see I'm a good actor, I care about them, we've established some kind of relationship, we've established some kind of common ground, they're inclined to listen to me, and maybe even to like me, and I tell a story, a first-person narrative about, yeah, you know, well, I'm for ACA because this happened to me, and had I not had ACA, I might have died of cancer. Like, that's really powerful when there's a human being sitting in front of you telling you, testifying as to how this policy has affected them positively. You know, I think that the more we have those first-person narratives, the more effective we are in these communications. And then the second, you know, the third-person narratives of, you know, I have a sister, I have a friend, I have a wife, I have a, you know, this is how, that's also that's also effective, but less effective than like the human being sitting in front of you telling you, this is my reality, and they trust you. They don't think you're just trying to manipulate them, right? So I think the more we can get in touch to how these things affect us personally and be able to articulate that, the more effective we are.
So that's kind of on an individual level. How would we do that in a broader level to reach people and have that kind of personal connection with them? Like, because there's a lot of fake news out there. So a lot of people are reading things that aren't even true, but they think it's true. So how do we combat that?
Yes. I mean, I do think when I look at, you know, I voted for, I hope it's not a surprise that I voted for Hillary Clinton, and I think she would have been an amazing president, and I think she was so boxed in on for so many different reasons because she's a woman leader, and being a woman leader is just an impossible job in many cases, especially in the U.S., where I think, you know, compared to other industrialized nations, we are not very progressive when it comes to gender. And having women leaders. So I would not cast aspersions on her campaign at all. But something I did see is there was this tendency to articulate policies and prescriptions and ideas in a somewhat abstract, independent, individualistic way, as opposed to a concrete, interdependent kind of, we're in this together. So something we know about the working class in the U.S. is this is a group that tends to be quite interdependent. These are people who really value being connected to each other and similar to each other and adhering to traditions and history and place. So that whole message of make America great again resonated really well with this group of folks who were already tending towards a more interdependent way of thinking, whereas a liberal Democrat way of thinking turns out to be quite independent. You know, we're going to make policies that are going to allow you to compete with each other fairly, basically, is the message, and that are going to redound to you, your personal financial and economic welfare, as opposed to speaking to people's sense of community and their sense of connection. So I do think something liberal Democrats should think about is how do we actually message to folks who have a more interdependent way of thinking rather than our own independent way of thinking. And I think sharing those like emotional stories is one way to go, as opposed to framing. You can frame the same policy in terms of this is going to help your community versus this is going to help you. And I think that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, but there's probably a level of distrust too, you know, coming from, I think a lot of them even distrust the media because they think of the media as very liberal. So
yeah,
it's hard to get through to them when there really are not that many channels to do so.
Right. So then you're talking about the media, not just the message. I do think there's a great distrust of media. I mean, and the traditional outlets. I mean, although there is also great trust of Fox News and Breitbart, yeah, and the conservative outlets. And so I think there's really an opportunity for some enterprising young Brooklynite or so to wander into that space and create, think carefully about what would it mean to create a news outlet that feels neutral to both liberals and conservatives. I haven't seen any. I think, you know, I tend to think that NPR is a decent outlet to that end. But then I sometimes hear stories and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can hear my brother's eyes rolling in his head from, 3,000 miles away. So I do think there's a real opportunity for the creation of a new news outlet that is expressly, that does a better job. And there's no such thing as neutrality. There's no such thing of objectivity. But actually, and I use this rubric of independence and interdependence, like that you're messaging things in these different styles that feel better to different audiences.
Yeah, I've actually been thinking a lot about that even before the election, and having some, there's no real accountability. So like news doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't mean it's true. You know, you can label anything news. So having some sort of rating system on the accuracy of it, and having, I don't know, maybe a handful of journalists or people who are directly involved in whatever the topic is, having some sort of feedback on it, and having, or maybe having like a rating system of whether or not this is accurate or not, because there's no real accountability, and I don't know how to build that in.
That's a really interesting idea. But you know, what comes to mind is there is, you know, NPR's on the media. There are a few, you know, sapling outlets that do that a little bit. I also wonder, you know, what is the news consuming public's appetite for these things? You know, I almost feel like there should be, and this is a very liberal Democrat approach, but there needs to be more regulation, you know, that if you are found to prevaricate whatever percentage of the time, like you're, you know, you don't, you know, like you lose your broadcasting license, or that would be a drastic approach, but there is some kind of entity that's kind of certifying how accurate your reporting is.
But how is that ever going to happen? We just elected someone to president who went around saying Obama wasn't born in America for years. You know, he switches what he's saying left and right. Like, he doesn't, facts don't really matter to him, it seems like.
Yeah, and something I think we should say about Trump is, like, I mean, when we talk about having conversations about difference and diversity, you know, Trump is an actual sociopath. Yeah. You know, like, this is not going to be the target of many of our efforts as individual citizens or even as media outlets. You know, there you're dealing with a different kind of creature altogether, and it is frightening. And this is something our nation's founders anticipated, and that's why they created the Electoral College, was to prevent someone like Trump getting elected. Interestingly, it's backfired. Well, although who knows, December 19th is not here yet. So I think, you know, two words that give me some solace at night, are term limits. You know, he is only elected for 4 years. And I think this is a time for us as, you know, people who have a different vision for how to build, a multicultural nation, we really need to get our act together.
And so you would say that's by having conversations with people who have this alternative belief and understanding where they're coming from, and then kind of relating something to you, like why you came up with the way you believe your ideas and stuff, and going from there. Is that really the best thing we could do individually and collectively?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the fancy political science term for it is coalition building. You know, the Democrats, I mean, for a variety of reasons, some of them not so great, have traditionally won the white working class, you know, for most of the last century, and then things, you know, turned around. But I do think, rather than continuing to alienate, I mean, our nation has become, at least in terms of voting patterns. Now, you know, that's a caveat there, but we have become more polarized. And I do feel like liberal Democrats are not doing the best job we could do, of communicating with, you know, white working class folks in rural areas, in suburban areas. So I think there's not only, you know, in your daily life, that's, you know, and thinking once again for our model of culture change in your daily life is, like, first of all, acknowledging your own privilege, your own cultural backgrounds, and kind of like where you are in this whole mix, and then reaching out to people who are different from you and having honest and empathic and supportive conversations with people who are not like you. I think that would go a long way. If not change in this whole coalition building that needs to happen, because once again, white working class is the largest voting bloc in the U.S. And I think that's something that many liberals living on the coast don't realize, or maybe they do now, but they didn't, 6 months ago. And then, I mean, there's many things that could be done at, in media and policy and education. And I mean, we can kind of periscope out from there. Of the interventions, but those are wonkier conversations. This is something I think all of us can start doing on Monday.
So, are these Trump supporters, are they older? Are they people watching Fox News, or are they millennials too?
I have the data I've seen are that millennials tend not to support Trump. That these are older white voters over the age of 35. The data I looked at and thought were showing that were not the most credible things. So I'm not sure exactly what the voting patterns were. I do know there was great turnout. So I think that's the other thing is, like, vote. get out there and vote. And people did turn out for this election pretty well.
It's interesting. I know two people I'm Facebook friends with, but one I grew up with, actually, and they both are white women and not super old. And they both voted for Trump and posted all over their Facebook pro-Trump things. And just wrapping my head around, I mean, I really do actually want to have a conversation with them, but just wrapping my head around why they think he will help the country is something I would really like to know, because I don't really, it's hard for me to understand, I guess, especially since one of them, we went to the same school from second grade to senior year in high school.
Well, you're in a unique position. You have a podcast channel or a podcast show, a podcast on a well attended channel. Have them on your show and ask them, why did you vote for Trump? I think that would be a really and kind of proceed with that conversation, in a respectful and careful way.
Yeah, because I'm really
that would
curious.
Be a term. Yeah, that would be a tremendous service, because I think, since the election, stories about why people voted for Trump have cropped up like mushrooms. But prior to the election, I think the only good story I saw about why people might vote for Trump was on cracked.com, and the editor there, his alias is David Wong. He's actually from working class Illinois, talked about, had he stayed in, rural Illinois, here's why he would have voted for Trump. And I thought that was really, and now that, that piece has been passed around to millions, but it's interesting to me that there was this real gap in reporting on why the hell people were voting. There was a lot of supposition. There was a lot of speculation that Trump supporters are racist and sexist and XYZ, but no one really talked to the Trump supporters.
Yeah, I'm looking at her Facebook, and she has a couple posts saying, all this negativity for our president-elect, like, you haven't given him a chance, and you're just saying negative stuff and hateful things and looking for an excuse. And I just find that so hypocritical, though.
Yeah, well...
How would you talk to someone like that, who's basically now saying, like, how dare people do this, when, before they were doing it for our current president, and, Trump does this negativity things about all types of people. How do you then communicate with someone who's doing the same thing that they're complaining about?
Yeah, I mean... From social psychology, we know that pointing out hypocrisy can be a very effective attitude change technique, but I think you can't dive in the deep end with that, especially if these are people in your own life. I still recommend you lead with interdependence. You lead with, like, I care about you. You're interesting to me. Tell me why you voted for Trump. And then let them, you know, build that bridge. Let them, enter the conversation and build that emotional trust and connection and relationship. And then, you know, kind of say, okay, well, you know, when you posted this thing about Trump, I felt, a little irritated because it seems that Trump used those same tactics of spewing negative media about Hillary. And then invite them to respond to that. You know, why is it okay that, but right now this is the limitation of social media. Although, you know, every post has comment fields. You can usually is like right on, you know, like how often have you seen an excellent back and forth on Facebook? Sometimes it happens, but it's not the norm. And so actually having a one-on-one conversation with people you disagree with in a respectful and relational way, I think, is going to help us not only, you know, go into it with the motivation of understanding, but you might be surprised that you persuade.
Well, when they say some, like, very inaccurate fact, how do you then say, you know, that's actually not true? You know, because a lot of them are going off information that is completely inaccurate, but they believe it to be true. So how do you now counter that when they say they believe in Trump because, X, Y, and Z is happening, even though that's not the case?
Yeah, so this is when you have to whip out the Jedi tricks. Because you taking the position that you have a unique purchase on reality is going to go over like a pregnant high jumper, right? Like, who died and made you the arbiter of objectivity? I think the way you have to handle those situations is say, huh, that's so interesting. So, and like, once again, frame this as an I statement. I read in the New York Times that, you know, actually the opposite is true. Or, you know, when I mean, this is of limited utility, but with my family, it's like, so yeah, you know, when I was writing my dissertation and surveying that literature, you know, you gotta be careful with that. 'Cause then you definitely lose people. They're like, thank you for your arrogance. So, I mean, I do think just instead of framing things of like, you're wrong, that's invalid, that's false, you have to just situate it in your own experience as a first person narrative of like, huh, that's really interesting because, you know, I read this. Where did you read that? Where did you hear that? And then we could have a conversation about, like, how valid are our sources? And I think all of us are suspicious of media at this point. And then we can have a conversation about, like, why might my sources be biased? Why might your sources be biased? Like, how would we ever know? Like, what can we do together to have a better purchase on the reality of the situation? But I think telling people that's false, you're wrong, is incredibly threatening. I think you really have to resituate that conversation and, you know, here are my sources. I mean, and, you know, and this is where you got to be on your A game. You've got to know what your sources are. Like, it never works to say, like, I just know better than you do, yeah. You know, even this is what I study and do for a living. Like, I can't get away with that, partly because I'm a woman, honestly, and that's really annoying. I sometimes think if I were a male academic, I would be allowed to say that a little bit more. But at the end of the day, it doesn't advance the conversation as much as you might think.
Does that happen in the academic environment as well, or more so?
Oh, yeah. I mean, academia is just as sexist as anything else, and maybe more so.
Well, I think you brought up a good point of sources, and I think even if you are on the liberal side, you should be checking your sources as well, because we have the same bias in a way that, you know, the other side has a bias. Like, you know, we read something and automatically think that it's true just because it's in the New York Times. And I think we all need to start researching more and kind of understanding what is actually fact and what isn't without just blindly believing something.
Yeah, I mean, I know a study came out last week from Stanford, where I teach and do research, showing that Stanford undergraduates cannot differentiate between real and fake news. You know, Stanford is now the most selective university in the country. So what is it that we as a nation have lost in terms of critical thinking? I think we all, I mean, this is, you know, another kind of culture change action item is encourage, you know, democracies do not trundle along without a lot of maintenance. And part of that maintenance is being an informed voter. And that sounds tedious, but like I can think of nothing better to do with my time because, you know, the alternatives are pretty disgusting. So I think actually for people to start questioning, do I believe this article? You know, I have some questions. How would I answer these questions? It's super ironic to me that this is coming about after the advent of the internet. I mean, you really can find out 90%, or maybe not 90, let's call it 80% of the world's knowledge without leaving your home. You know, but people aren't using that tool. Instead, the tool is backfired and people are allowing themselves to be spoon-fed half-truths. And that's very sad.
I'm hoping that this election, the good thing, if we can get something good from it, is that people are going to be less complacent. You know, sometimes you need to burn something down and then rebuild. But the way things seem to be going is it's pretty horrifying. And people seem to be horrified, but maybe that will create change. You know, when you have no other options, you're like backed in the corner. That's when you need to get creative. And so maybe that's what this is going to do for people, is energize them and be like, well, what can we do? You know, like what's thinking outside the box, like being, you know, inventive about it, because it seems like the current methods aren't really working right now. And now we have a reason to kind of change that. Like there's a lot of different opportunities to do that, it seems like.
Yes. I mean, that is the hope. The hope is that, I mean, because you can imagine it going either way. You can see this as a galvanizing, catalyzing election where especially the, you know, liberal Democrats are like, oh my gosh, you know, we need to come up with an action plan and execute. And I do think some of that is going to be creativity and innovation. But I also think a lot of it is kind of relearning what we already knew. I feel like there's a lot of, you know, our education system has been cratered for the past 30 years, and a lot of wisdom about how to run a democracy got flushed down the toilet. And I think revisiting civics and civics and psychology would do us all very well. I mean, because the other alternative is that people are so disgusted that they abandon the democratic ideal. You know, I think the U.S. is an experiment. You know, people left to their own devices are very tribal. At least that's what human history seems to suggest, is that we live in small communities, we shun outsiders. You know, this whole experiment in diversity is new. The way we're doing it is new, and I would hate to see us give up on that experiment so soon.
Yeah, I guess it's disheartening because I think people feel powerless. You know, if you're going to have the whole government controlled by one party, how do you make change? How do you prevent them from going backwards? Because it seems like a lot of what they want to do is really going backwards in a negative way.
Yeah, I mean, the rays of hope I see. I mean, I don't want to sound too Pollyannish. It is scary, you know. And but once again, 2 years, we have a midterm election in 2 years. We've got 2 years to get our act together and get a different Congress in place. And you know, that's well you know, there have been plenty of times in American history where that's happened, that the midterm election actually released one party's control on Congress. So we're talking, I mean, how much damage can Trump do in 2 years? I mean, probably a lot, you know, but like we do, unless he takes away our right to vote, we stand a fighting chance. And I think that's important. And the other ray of hope I see is even many of the Republicans in Congress did not support Trump. You know, I mean, Trump in some ways is a third party candidate. And I think a lesson that Democrats can learn from the Republican playbook is Republicans are very good at getting behind one idea, even if they don't agree with it completely. And I do worry that they will do that, that the dissent within the Republican Party is about to evaporate. But meanwhile, I think we as Democrats, or, you know, a Green Party voters, you know, actually get together on the same page and, like, don't let infighting reduce our power. Because that is usually what happens with, I mean, that's a liberal ideology right there, is that every voice counts and we're more interested in the plurality of opinions rather than like, let's get some shit done and decide on one action plan and execute, you know, like that's not what Democrats do, but I think we might need to do that.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a bit of a wandering answer that went one place and another.
I think it's true. And I mean, we'll see if this vote recount happens, because I'm very interested, because I feel like a lot of our voting rights have been taken away, especially with the whole Bernie Sanders situation that I will one day get over. But yeah, okay. So this has been super interesting, and I'm personally going to reach out and try to understand where people are coming from, and, you know, in a person's statements kind of reiterate why I feel the way I do and try to offer up information that may be a little more accurate without saying that. But thank you so much. How can people find you? Like, what's your blog again?
Yes, it's so my blog is alanaconner.com, and my name is A-L-A-N-A-C-O-N-N-E-R. And my book is Clash, How to Thrive in a Multicultural World. It's available on Amazon. Makes a great gift for all your Trump-supporting friends and family. and then cultureclashes.org is the website for the book. And then finally, my center at Stanford, it's called Spark, which is S-P-A-R-Q. So it's sparq.stanford.edu. You can find all sorts of ideas about how to make the world a better place there.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on. Really, really appreciate it. Very enlightening.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This was a wonderful conversation.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Take care.